So it kind of equals out. Anyway, I hope everyone had a good Shabbos, and of course, yesterday was Shabbos Mevorachin, for the month of Nisan, and although, again, Pesach cleaning might give people some anxiety, but in point of fact, Shabbos Mevorachin Nisan is a very, very happy moment, because Nisan, again, is the month of Geula, the month of Yeshua. Chazal tell us, Chazal say, we were redeemed in Nisan, and the future redemption will also be in the month of Nisan. In fact, it was said, to look ahead a little bit, that every Shabbos Mevorach in Iyar, Rav Moshe Feinstein always seemed a little sad, because he said, ay, 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 the month of Nisan is almost over, and perhaps our best chance for Geula is not present. But Baruch Hashem, now we're looking forward to the great, great month of Geula, the month of Yeshua, and B'ezras Hashem, it should indeed be a month of Yeshua for Klal Yisrael. In fact, I'll tell you a little word about looking forward to Mashiach. Everyone remembers, I'm getting ahead of myself a little, but everybody remembers at the Seder, we have the first Hillel sandwich, right? That's why I never understood why the Earl of Sandwich gets credit for inventing the sandwich. Avada, Hillel was centuries before the Earl of Sandwich, and he invented it. And it's very clear, by the way, that this was a shawarma. In other words, it was soft matzah for sure, because you can't, korech means like to bend and wrap. You can't wrap hard matzah, as all of us know. So clearly it was a shawarma. You had the lamb of the Korban Pesach, and you had salatim, you had your rakot, you know, the maror, etc. And that's what it was. But it's interesting that this, now what is Hillel's basis that you got to eat it together? Because the Torah says, al matzos umaro rerim yochluhu. You eat the Korban Pesach together with matzah and maror. The Chachamim say that just means at the same occasion. It doesn't have to be bikricha in a sandwich. Hillel takes those words very literally, and we want to fulfill all the different views, so we first eat them separately, and then we eat them as a sandwich, right? This is Zecher LeMikdash KeHillel. But what's interesting is the phrase, with slight variations, there are some differences, al matzos umarim yachlua actually appears twice. In Parshas Bo, it appears in connection with the Korban Pesach. In Parshas Baloscha, it repeats the halacha for Pesach Sheni, that if you're Tameh, a month later. And what's interesting is, the Pasuk the Haggadah quotes is the wording of Pesach Sheni, which really doesn't make sense. I mean, we really should quote the Pasuk about the regular Korban Pesach. So they say, v'shem the Belzer Rebbe, that here's the point. The point is that we are so eager for the Geula and Mashiach that we want to invoke the next possible opportunity to eat the Korban Pesach. The next possible opportunity will not be next Pesach. It will be a month later, Pesach Sheni, because if Mashiach were to come after Pesach, before Pesach Sheni, we would all bring Pesach Sheni. And therefore, even in the Haggadah we say, Chaval, if Chas V'Shalom Mashiach doesn't come, so it's yet another Seder. Without a Geula, but we're looking forward to Pesach Sheni, that maybe even in the next month, there will still be a Geula. And therefore there's a subtle remez in the Haggadah itself about the yearning that we have for the Geula. But to go back a little bit, we have finished the book of Shmos, and yesterday was indeed, because of the double Parsha, as well as Parsha's Parit, was the longest Kriyas HaTorah of the year. I hope you had a fast Balkari. When the Balkari does it slowly, it can take quite long. And this is the Siyum of Melechet HaMishkan. And as the Ramban writes, the book of Shmos has three main ideas with some detours, some unfortunate detours. Idea number one, or theme number one, is Yitzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus of Egypt. Theme number two is the purpose of the Exodus of Egypt, and that is receiving the Torah at Har Sinai. And then unfortunately we had a detour with the Chedo Ego, but theme number three, in a positive sense, is Melechas HaMishkan. And this is the trajectory of spiritual life. We escape, or we try to liberate ourselves with Hashem's help, from all of the mitzarim, the limitations, the constraints, the constrictions. We try to liberate ourselves from egotism and selfishness and gaiva and taiva, And then we're ready to be makabel HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will, which is Matan Torah. But what is the ultimate goal that even goes beyond Matan Torah? Is that we make our lives a tabernacle, a dwelling place for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is the as the Sefer Charedim said, and indeed this is a beautiful nigun, Bilvavi Mishkan Evne, that in my heart I build a Mishkan. Mishkan means a dwelling place for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the whole Mishkan, is and on Beis HaMikdash as well, is nothing more than a symbol of the potential that we have to build a Mishkan for HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our hearts and in our soul. And therefore that's the culmination. Get rid of the Midos Ra'os to whatever degree we can. And that is the symbolic meaning of getting rid of chametz, because chametz represents arrogance, puffed up. It represents the Yetzer Hara. Getting rid of chametz is the chametz of the heart that a person gets rid of. And through bir chametz, which is, as David HaMelech calls it, sor meira, by eradicating the negative, we can then reach the madrega of aseh tov to be able to do good. Matan Torah, we're makabel Hashem's Torah. And then we reach the highest level of building a Mishkan in our heart. That is Bilvavi Mishkan Evna, that I build a Mishkan for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right, so that's the Shmos. In the macro sense is of course the story of what happens to Bnei Yisrael, but there's a micro sense. There's an idiosyncratic sense. There's a personalized idea in which you apply this, we apply this to the journey that we go through in our lives. And that is why cleaning for Pesach, as difficult as it is extremely important spiritually. In fact, some say, it's an old Hasidic aphorism, you know, in Hebrew we have the expression, hakol beseder, that everything is okay. But some want to apply that hakol beseder, that in the Seder of Pesach is hakol. Everything in my life, in my growth, in my relationship to Hashem is alluded to in the Seder of the Pesach. Seder of the Pesach is HaKol B'Seder. Everything is in that particular Seder. So I want to focus really on a technical point, but again, it's a very, very interesting point of the Meshech Chochmah. And that is, there are two places in the Torah, one in Kisisa and one in Vayakel, when there is a juxtaposition between building the Mishkan and not doing work on Shabbos. Let's take Vayakel first. When was Vayakel stated? Moshe Rabbeinu comes down on Yom Kippur with the second Luchais, signifying that Hashem has forgiven the sin of the golden calf. There's a bit of a catch-22. What is the relationship between Yom Kippur and the Kapara of the Chet HaEgel? Is it the pshat that the Chet HaEgel was forgiven because that day was Yom Kippur? Or did that day become Yom Kippur because that is the day Hashem forgave the Chet HaEgel? In other words, which is the reason? Meaning, is there something intrinsic in the holiness of that day that caused the kapara? Or pumfakert, the other way around, that day became the Day of Atonement because that was the great day in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu forgave the Chet HaEgel. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So is there an inheritance that Hashem put into the creation?
Well, yeah, but again, that in a sense just restates the question. It's certainly a quality of the day, but the question is, was that from Shesha Shemei Breishis, or was that because the Chet HaEgel put it into that day, right? So that would be the same question. Okay, now. So when did the Jewish people begin constructing the Mishkan? So Vayakel, the day after Yom Kippur, Moshe assembles all the people, and he says, Eila Hadvarim, these are the commandments, and he talks about Shabbos first, and then he talks about Mishkan. And that's when people contribute to the Mishkan, and of course the contribution and the construction is Nimshach all the way until Nisan, because the Mishkan is actually dedicated Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Actually, they began to put it up and take it down 1 week before. Those are called the 7 days of Miluim, the 7 days of preparation. And Rosh Chodesh Gimel Adar is when it begins, and Rosh Chodesh Nisan is the Hakamas HaMishkan, and that is when the 12 Nisim, right, later on in Bamidbar, they brought their offerings, right? So don't confuse these two periods. People sometimes confuse them. There were 7 preliminary days in which every single day the Mishkan was put up and taken down. And the one who did all of the service during those 7 days of Miluim was Moshe Rabbeinu. Aaron was not yet the Kohen. Moshe was the Kohen for those 7 days. And that lasted from the 23rd of Adar to Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the Mishkan was put up in a permanent way, although it's going to be moved, obviously, from place to place. That was the day that Aaron and his children officially became the Kohanim. That happens to be the day, we'll see later, where Nadav and Avihu meet their death on that very day of Hakamas HaMishkan. Right, so just putting together these different events so you have a sense of the timetable. And that was the day that the 12 Nisim, the 12 heads of the tribes, brought their offerings from the first day of Nisan to the 12th day of Nisan, including the Shabbos in between. And then, of course, after that, shortly after, you had the first Pesach, the first and only Pesach that was kept in the desert. Again, another thing we have to remember. There are only 2 Korban Pesachs, Korbanot Pesachim, that are brought in the Torah. One was the Pesach in Mitzrayim itself, and the other was the first year after they left Mitzrayim. They brought 1 Korban Pesach. After that, there were no other Korban Pesach that they brought in the Midbar. So Machlokas, why in the Gemara, why didn't they bring, they didn't bring another Korban Pesach till Yehoshua ben Nun's time, when they crossed the Yarden. So for 39 years, they did not bring a Korban Pesach, even though there was a Mishkan, even though they brought Korbanos. They brought plenty of Korbanos. They did not bring the Korban Pesach. There was a Machlokas in the Gemara and in Midrashim why they didn't bring a Korban Pesach. One reason is because after the Chet HaMeraglim, which happened later that year, they stopped circumcising their children, because since they were no longer totally protected by Hashem, it would be dangerous for them to do a bris milah, because they didn't have the special protection of Hashem. And as a result, you cannot bring a Korban Pesach if you have, not only if you're uncircumcised, but even if you have a child that is uncircumcised, you're not allowed to bring the Korban Pesach. In a way, that's a difficult reason. I mean, did every single person, you know, I mean, nobody brought a Korban Pesach because of this? I mean, there must have been somebody that didn't have a child. But still, according to one opinion, this is why there was no Korban Pesach. According to the other opinion, it actually is a Gezeiras HaKasev. It's very interesting. That Korban Pesach is actually a mitzvah Teluya Bi'aretz. It actually is a mitzvah that's connected with coming to Eretz Yisrael. And it was a Chiddush that they brought it in the desert. Meaning, it's not a chiddush they didn't bring it the other years. That would be the normal halacha. But Hashem wanted 1 Korban Pesach to be brought in the desert. Okay, that's a little bit of a timeline, just so you clearly differentiate between the 7 days of Miluim and the 12 days of Chanukas HaNisim. Okay, the 12 days of Chanukas HaNisim start from Rosh Chodesh Nisan till the 12th. The Shiva Shmei Miluim are the 7 days before that. Yeah.
I think recall learning that they finished everything for the Mishkan by the 25th.
That's correct. There actually is a Medrash that everything was completed by the 25th of Kislev. And by rights, that should have been the dedication of the Mishkan. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to move it to Nisan, which was the month of Geula. And therefore he promised, so to speak, the 25th of Kislev would in the future be a day of rededication, and of course, thousands of years later, it was the dedication of Hanukkah. That is correct. Okay. Now, going back to Vayakhel, again, I just wanted to set the chronological scene a little bit. Going back to Vayakhel, so the day after Yom Kippur, Moshe prefaces his discussion of the Mishkan with not doing work on Shabbos. Rashi explains, again, from the Gemara, that this is to teach us that even though there's a mitzvah to build a Mishkan, you cannot do so on Shabbos. And indeed, the very definition of what are the malachos that you're not allowed, what are the activities you're not allowed to do on Shabbos, are defined by things that were done in the Mishkan. So we say there are 39 malachos. That is because there were 39 different types of creative activities that were involved in Melechas HaMishkan, which means every single malacha, in order to be a malacha, it had to be something that was involved in the construction of the Mishkan. So you might say, hey, plowing? Plowing? Cooking? What does that have to do with building the Mishkan? Again, we're not looking at the korbanos, we're looking at the building. Well, some of it is very indirect. In order to build the Mishkan, they had to dye the urios. They had to dye the curtains and the tapestries. Well, in order to have dye, you got to have plants that have dye. In order to plant, you have to plow the ground, to plant the seeds, to harvest, and then you cook the dyes. So, interestingly enough, the cooking in the Mishkan that makes it a malacha was not the cooking of food, at least according to most opinions. It was the cooking of the dyes for which they had to, for which they colored, they dyed the urios. Right? Again, some machlokes. Some rishonim learn that you can count korbanos as part of Mishkan malacha. So they actually say the malacha of cooking was the baking of the lechem apanim. And that's why some call the malacha, technically, the malacha of cooking they call ofe, baking, and some call it cooking. So it depends if the origin, both are forbidden, I mean there's no question. There's no practical difference here, I mean you can't bake, you can't cook. But the question is, what is the prototypical Mishkan malacha, which is the source? Is it the cooking of the dyes, or is it the baking of the lechem hapanim? And that would mean you're not limited to construction. But be it as it may, Moshe Rabbeinu basically says, you don't build a Mishkan on Shabbos, and that is the definition of prohibited malacha. What is the basic idea? So again, there's a very famous, perhaps I shouldn't use him as a source, but a very well-known idea, and the person deserves credit. This is Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Of course, there's an interesting story. Somebody once went to Rav Huttner and said over a certain thought. And Rav Huttner slapped him and said, "You read that in Heschel." Which means Rav Huttner was critical that he read Heschel, but Rav Huttner knew. So but anyway, Rabbi Heschel, who was he? Again, he was in many ways very, very distinguished person in many ways, although there are other ways that we would differ with him. He makes the point that there are two types of holiness in the world. There is the holiness of space, Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim, the Beis HaMikdash, Kedushas Makam. But then there is the holiness of Zman, the holiness of time. Right? In Judaism, we have two types of Kedusha. There are places that are holy, and there are times that are holy. And in Judaism, the holiness of time is more significant than the holiness of space. Because the holiness of space, by definition, is physical. It is bounded by physicality. And God, by definition, is infinite. And although time itself is connected to matter, but time is abstracted from matter in a sense. In fact, without getting into too many technical things, when the Vilna Gaon had his great, great disagreements with the early Hasidic movements, so people focus on many, many different things, they weren't keeping Zman Tefillah, etc. But actually the single most important machlokas is a very arcane machlokas, a very technical machlokas. But at least in those times it was viewed as very, very significant. One of the teachings of Chabad, in particular, the Baal HaTanya, is the notion that God is in everything, that nothing can exist without the essence of God within it. The Vilna Gaon considered that to be Avodah Zarah, considered that to be pantheism, in which you can't say that God is in everything, because then you've turned everything into God. And the whole concept of defining God or confining God by reference to any type of physicality. So again, this may sound a little bit of a subtle debate, but this was a major, major debate. This was actually the single most important issue. Then you had the side issues, they don't do this, they don't do this, those were different issues that were discussed. So Rabbi Heschel makes the point, therefore, that the reason Shabbos overrides Mishkan is because Mishkan is holiness of space, and Shabbos is holiness of time. And time is a spiritual dimension that is closer to the spirituality of the Creator than is the holiness of place. Okay, but be this in there. Okay, now, so all of us know this. This is the halacha. But problem is this. This is not the first time that this juxtaposition appears. You may recall, after Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh, which is the Mishkan and the Big Day Kahuna, in the beginning of Kisisa, before the sin of the golden calf, after everything was said about the Mishkan and everything else, we have the famous verses that many still recite Friday night, and Shabbos morning as well, for Kiddush. V'shamru v'nei Yisrael es ha-Shabbos, they shall keep Shabbos as an eternal sign. I say some, because although it is the Ashkenazic minhag, but the minhag of the Gra is not to say v'shamru, so in many yeshivos, we actually do not say v'shamru Friday night. Okay, but be this at night. It's in the Torah. Now, here's the question. You will notice that in Parshas Kisisa, Shabbos appears after the discussion of the Mishkan. So when Hashem speaks to Moshe, He tells them all about the Mishkan, then He tells them about Shabbos. When Moshe speaks to Bnei Yisrael, He tells them about Shabbos, and then He tells them about Mishkan. It's very clear, the order is exactly reversed. Now, if you look in Rashi, Rashi, unfortunately, doesn't help us very much here. Because Rashi says the meaning is identical in both cases. Rashi says, in the first case it means Hashem is saying, even though I told you about Mishkan, Shabbos is more important. And in Vayakel, I'm telling you about Shabbos before Mishkan because Shabbos is more important. So Rashi interprets both things to say the same idea. Now, just doing it in a verbally different way. The first way it is, even though I just told you about Mishkan, but I'm telling you something even more important. And in the second way, I'm telling you the important thing first. So according to Rashi, you really have a very difficult kasha. And that is, why, if the Torah is communicating the same message, number one, why do it twice? And number two, why do it in a different way when you're doing it twice? It's the same message. So, there's a beautiful, beautiful explanation from the Meshech Chachma. And the Meshech Chachma does this type of thing in several places in the Torah. You know, there's a whole genre of, I don't know what they call it, of people who like to write novels based on alternative historical scenarios. What would have happened, you know, had Hitler, you know, conquered England, or what would have happened if Roosevelt didn't run for his third term? Or maybe part of our fantasies, what would have happened if Barack Obama wouldn't have been elected? Okay. Anyway. But, no, okay. Now, actually, I get in very big trouble if I make any political comments. I'm going to shut up about it. Okay. Anyway, the thing is that the Meshech Chachma likes to reconstruct what form the Torah would have taken had there not been a Cheta Egel. And let me just throw out his answer first, and then we'll see the explanation of it. His point is this. When Hashem had told Moshe about the Mishkan, that's before the sin of the golden calf. Zok de Meshech Chachma, had there not been a Chet HaEgel, Mishkan would have overridden Shabbos. And that's why Mishkan is first. Mishkan is first. When Hashem, it is only as a result of the Chet HaEgel that Shabbos overrides Mishkan. And therefore he explains that the switching in the sequencing of the Torah is merames to me that the form of the Mishkan would have been different had there not been a Cheta Egel, as opposed to the Mishkan after the Cheta. Now, we'll explain why that is so, but I just want you to understand that that's an ingenious interpretation of why the order is different, because one represents a pre-Cheta Egel Mishkan, and one represents a post-Cheta Egel Mishkan. But in order to understand the Meshech Chachma, I have to give you a hakdama of a very other important point. And that is, there is a fundamental machlokas, Rashi and the Ramban, regarding the correct historical sequence of Parshios Truma and Tetzaveh. Truma and Tetzaveh are the Parshios about the commandments of building the Mishkan. Ramban, well, let me start with Rashi. Rashi actually learns that all of these parshiyos about the Mishkan, all of them were given after the Chayei Egel. Not just Vayakel when Moshe is talking to the people, but even Hashem's commandment to Moshe is after the Chayei Egel. According to Rashi, Ein muktam umu'uchar batorah. The Torah is not following chronological order, and you actually rip out, so to speak, Truma and Tetzaveh and put it after the Chayei Egel. Now, right off the bat, obviously the Meshech Chachma cannot be going with Rashi. Because if the Meshech Chachma is learning that the order of Truma and Tetzaveh represents a pre-Chayei Egel Mishkan, according to Rashi, there was no pre-Chayei Egel Mishkan. According to Rashi, everything was given afterwards, right? And that could be why Rashi didn't give the Meshech Chachma's explanation. Okay, but putting that aside, what are the implications of Rashi? It's worthy. I was not here for Parshas Truma Tetzaveh, so it's worthwhile to talk about this a little bit and understanding the whole picture. So there are three, Rashi doesn't say, Rashi just points out that had there not been a Chayei Egel, there wouldn't have been a Mishkan. This is amazing. The Mishkan is a response to the Chayei Egel, and Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh are all out of order. Ein muktam umu'uchar batorah. Why is that so? So there are three different explanations that are given for Rashi's position. Explanation number one is the Sepurno. Now he's not explaining Rashi, but he himself comes to the same conclusion. The Sepurno says, had there not been a Chayei Egel, Hashem would have been accessible everywhere. You wouldn't need a special place. You wouldn't need a special ritual. You wouldn't need special people like Kohanim. Anybody could be a Kohen. Every backyard could be a Mikdash. The Mishkan, says the Sepurno, and the Beis HaMikdash, although it's a wonderful, wonderful gift, it really represents a certain failing on our part that we connect to Hashem only in a unique makom, in a unique way, by specially qualified people. In the ideal world, and remember, after Matan Torah, before the Chayei Egel, we reach the level of Adar HaRishayim before the Chayei Egel. We wouldn't have died. We were eternal. We were immortal. We wouldn't have needed a Mishkan. So according to the Sepurno, the Mishkan and the Mikdash, as wonderful as it is that Hashem gives us the opportunity to connect to Him that way, is really a yerida from the ultimate idea that Hashem could be reachable no matter what. That is interpretation number one, which is a bit pessimistic, but it represents the Mishkan as a yerida. That's the pshat of Rashi. There is a second explanation that is much earlier. In fact, it's actually earlier than Rashi himself. This is the Kuzari. Rav Yehuda Halevi. Rav Yehuda Halevi points out that if you look in the Parsha of the Chayei Egel, you will see that no person believed that the Egel was a god that they made. They did say, Kum asei lanu Elohim. Let us make for ourselves, now Elohim, I'm saying Elohim because obviously it's not a reference to Hashem, but it doesn't even mean divinity with a small g, because Elohim means give us a power, because he goes down and says, Kizem Moshe Ish. Let us make an Elohim, because Moshe the man, that's a word that didn't even have to be there, we don't know where he is. He's disappeared, he hasn't come down. It's very clear from the Pasuk that the Egel was a substitute for Moshe Rabbeinu, not for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Kuzari explains that the Jewish people didn't understand how they could relate to an invisible, intangible, non-physical God. They thought they needed an intermediary that could channel the spiritual energy into their physical needs. And they had perceived Moshe as that spiritual channeler. And when Moshe is not here and they've lost Moshe, they feel that there's such a chasm, such a gap between the Borei Olam and the Nivra, that they wanted some physical entity. And we don't even understand these processes, but they're actually quite deep. A physical entity that could challenge divine energy. Again, the Ramban actually makes the same point. The Ramban points out that one of the faces on God's celestial throne, on the Kisei HaKavod, is the Pnei HaShor, the face of the ox. This is in Yechezkel. And that is the Hashkacha Pratis in the Midbar that is filled with, you know, grass. So they wanted to channel a divine Koach that would help them in the Midbar. So what was their, yeah?
Any reason why Dafka, a calf, not something else, sheep, or?
It's hard to know. Part of it is that the calf or the cow is very, very powerful. So it represents, it's a stronger infusion of divine energy. So what was their mistake? Their mistake was not Avodah Zorah Mamish. Their mistake was the idea that we worship God through tangible intermediaries, as opposed to coming to HaKadosh Baruch Hu directly. And we shouldn't even look at Moshe Rabbeinu as an intermediary. In fact, this is the whole discussion that even today, people sometimes fall into traps, whether it's their relationship to a particular Rebbe, or when they go to Kivrei Tzadikim, and they pray to the dead, Chas V'Shalom, you're not allowed to pray to the dead. You have to only pray to Hashem, that in the Zechus of Tzadikim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, yes, we only pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In fact, some people are so strict on this that even in Shalom Aleichem, the third stand, they'll welcome the angels and send them home, but they're not going to say Borchuni l'shalom. They don't say to the angel, give me a bracha, because that's like asking the angel for something. You only ask HaKadosh Baruch. But here's what Rabbi Yehuda Levi says. This is his fascinating idea. That when people have a need and a weakness, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tries to compensate them and give them an avenue in which their weaknesses can be met. Very, very interesting. The Gemara says it even by food. There's a Gemara that says, every single food that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says you're not allowed to eat, He gave you a kosher replacement that tastes somewhat the same way. Right, now today, of course, with chemical processing, you can certainly have kosher shrimp and kosher lobster and whatever it is. But even b'teva, there's going to be something that's just as good. Maybe almost as good, or just as good. Almost as good. So the Kuzari says, if Klal Yisrael said they needed a physicality and a materialistic intermediary because they couldn't relate to Hashem without a physical metzias, I'll give them a Mishkan. And what's at the holiest part of the Mishkan? On top of the Aron HaKodesh? Are two angelic figures? Idols, really. Now, they're covered up. They're kept way in the background. Nobody sees them, except the Kohen Gadol. But at least psychologically, Am Yisrael has this sense that there's a physical channeling power. So the Kuzari sees it also as weakness. But instead of the notion of punishment, you're not worthy of being connected to God, so you're going to have to come to God through a mishkan, he sees it as compensating for the spiritual deficits of the people. In fact, it's brought down, and this is a bit of a controversial idea, so do not take this as halacha unless you talk to your rav or your rebbe or your mashpia or your rebbetzin, that in Sifrei Chassidus it is brought down that although chas v'shalom, it is absolutely, totally forbidden for anyone to believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a physical image. And the Torah says it over and over and over again. And to believe that Hashem, chas v'shalom, has a physical image is a form of Avodah Zarah. That's for sure. But some Sifrei Chassidus and Kabbalah say that to be ma'orer a person's kavana, as long as they know it's not a true representation, they are allowed to perceive HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a human form, in the sense of a loving father or a person with a long white beard, etc. Because Chazal themselves use this metaphor. They say at various points HaKadosh Baruch Hu was nidma this way and he looked this way. So as long as a person, again, as they say, this is controversial, I'm not saying it's as a ritual that should be practiced, but there is a concept that if you need that type of visualization, it is a permissible visualization to employ, as long as a person understands it is simply a visualization, it is not a reality. That's why we always add the word kav yochol, as if it was possible, That's if to say it's not really possible, but I sometimes need... Chazal used such an expression. Well, I mean, again, in a way, the Torah talks about the hand of Hashem, the eyes of Hashem. I mean, what is that doing? That is essentially using the metaphors of physicality, and in the language of Chazal, kedei l'saber, not l'shaber, it's l'saber es ha'ozen, so that my ear can absorb certain messages that I otherwise would not be able to grasp. Yeah.
Didn't Yaakov ask for the Malach when he had the with the Sarvesa? Didn't he ask for the
Bracha? That is a very good Malach. That is a very good question. Yaakov asked the Malach, but it's a very excellent question. It's Mamish Akasha and those who don't say Baruchuni L'Shalom. But the short answer is that Yaakov's understanding of spirituality was so deep that he knew that everything came from Hashem. So the Malach was just doing nothing on his own. As opposed to us, we could fall into the trap of looking at Malachim as having power. Yeah.
About the non-physicality of God, we just read in the Parsha that the cloud appeared.
Yep.
Isn't that something physical? That God in the cloud?
Yes, it is physical. But again, as the Malbim explains, the fire, both the cloud and the fire, Hashem is in the cloud and the fire. Hashem is not the cloud and the fire. He's in the cloud and the fire. So certainly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is mitlabesh, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu could be enveloped, Har Sinai as well. HaKadosh Baruch Hu can be enveloped in all sorts of things. But don't confuse that with the Metzias of Hashem. See, the Kavod Hashem, this is what all the Rishonim say, Kavod Hashem, the glory of God is not God. The glory of God is just like a king. A king comes to a place with a retinue, with an army. So Hashem has the kavod of malachim, the kavod of clouds, of fire. But that is not Hashem. Hashem is not the fire. Hashem might be in the fire, but that's a very different thing. No, well, it's different again. Think about it even in terms of human terms, right? A king comes in and he has a huge, huge army. The army is not the king. The army is there to give homage to the king. So all of these things create the reverence of Hashem for Hashem, but they're not Hashem. Okay. Now there's a third explanation, which is the simplest of all. Again, this is in Rashi's position. In other words, we're trying to explain why there wouldn't have been a Mishkan had there not been a Chet Egel. Sepurno says, without the Chet Egel, we would have had unlimited access to God. Yudal Levi says that had we been on the highest level, we wouldn't have needed physicality. The Mishkan is a concession to our weakness. The third explanation is, the Medrash says, Pashut, and that is, after the Chet HaEgel, Hashem wanted to show us that His love for us is undiminished. So the Mishkan was a siman min hashamayim, that the Chet HaEgel was niskaper, that it was atoned. Now, all of this is Rashi's Shita. But remember, Ramban has a totally different Shita. Ramban doesn't like the rule, ein mukta mamukher b'torah. Now, we can't get rid of it totally, because Chazal say it, and there are places in the Torah where you're absolutely forced to do it. Bamidbar is a very good example. Sefer Bamidbar begins with a census, Rosh Chodesh Iyar of the second year, but in the next parsha, we talk about the Nesiim bringing the dedication offerings, which was Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Even Ramban is forced to say, Ein mukta mamukher b'torah. But the Ramban's general gisha, his general approach is that we say it as little as we need to, and our normal assumption is that the events in the Chumash are recorded in accordance with chronological order. And if the Ramban says, Pasha, certainly when Moshe was in Har Sinai for the first 40 days before the Chet HaEgel, Hashem gave him the Mishkan Truma Tetzaveh, but he didn't get around to telling Bnei Yisrael till after the Chet HaEgel, because the Chet HaEgel happened and Moshe had to pray in the light. In other words, exactly the way the Chumash writes it. So now, we have given a Hakdama for the Meshech HaEgel. So now we do have a problem. Because if, according to Ramban, when Hashem told Moshe about the Mishkan, he first mentioned Mishkan then Shabbos, and that's before the Chet HaEgel. But after the Chet HaEgel, Moshe mentioned Shabbos and then Mishkan. So the Meshech Chachma's answer is that had there not been a Chet HaEgel, we would have built the Mishkan on Shabbos, and it's only a result of the Chet HaEgel that we don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Now, why is that so? So you understand structurally how he answers the question. In other words, you already have the answer to the question, although we don't have the explanation for the answer. But this is his answer to the question. So he says the following. Let's think about this halachically for a moment. We're not allowed to build the Mishkan on Shabbos, or the Beis HaMikdash for that matter, right? We cannot do this on Shabbos because these are malachos, can't do them on Shabbos. And yet, if you think about it, many, many korbanos were brought on Shabbos all the time. If you walked into the Beis HaMikdash, you would think, you know, hey, you throw stones here. Chilul Shabbos, what's going on? They're shechting, and they're cooking, and they're making fires. They're doing all sorts of things. How, right? The Korban Tamid was brought every day, including Shabbos. The Musaf, now, private offerings were not brought on Shabbos. If you needed to bring a sin offering, you could not bring it on Shabbos. That much is true. But anything that was a communal offering, a Korban Sibur, whether it was incense, whether it was the Korban Tamid, whether it was the Korban Musaf, and if it was Shabbos and Yom Tov or Rosh Chodesh, we would throw in the Rosh Chodesh offerings and the Yom Tov offerings. All of it was done on Shabbos. Korban Pesach, if Erev Pesach is on Shabbos, we would shech the Korban Pesach on Shabbos and the like. So the question is, this is called Avoda, right? The divine service is Doche Shabbos, but the building of the Mishkan is not Doche Shabbos. What's the difference? So the simple difference is a difference that we see. I'll give you a parallel in the mitzvah of Bris Milah. We know if a baby is born on Shabbos, right? So we do the Bris. If the baby can have an 8-day Bris, we do the Bris on Shabbos. Even though doing a Bris involves malachos, causing the bleeding, etc., it's a malacha. And yet, Bris Milah overrides Shabbos. Now, what about if the Moel lives far away? And the Moel cannot walk to the Bris. Is a Moel allowed to drive to do the Bris on Shabbos? Absolutely not. If there's no Erev, and this would involve carrying from inside a house to outside a house, is a Moel allowed to bring the knife to the Bris? No. And the difference basically is, we differentiate between the actual mitzvah of Bris Milah, which overrides Shabbos, and what are called the preliminary stages of a Bris Milah, which do not override Shabbos. Right? Driving to the Bris is what is called a Hechsher Mitzvah. It is not an actual mitzvah. Carrying the knife is a Hechsher Mitzvah. Again, there's all sorts of discussions. What you can tell a goy to do, it's true that we actually are relatively lenient in what you can tell a goy to do on Shabbos in order to facilitate a Bris. So we might allow the goy to carry the knife, etc., and even to tell them explicitly. You don't even have to hint, but that's okay. That's a separate issue. That's a question of telling a goy. But the moel can only do the bris, which violates Shabbos. You cannot do the machshirei milah. And the logic of that is a very good logic, and that is the milah can only be done on the eighth day properly. So therefore, you got to do it on Shabbos. All of the preliminaries could have been done before Shabbos. Now, good. You were negligent, you didn't do it, alright, but that's not going to allow you to be Mechalel Shabbos because you could have done it before Shabbos. That's why, by the way, once the Bris is not on the eighth day, you cannot do it on Shabbos because why do it on the ninth day, do it on the tenth day. Right, there's no difference between a ninth day Bris and a tenth day Bris as opposed to an eighth day Bris, which has a special day. So the Meshech Chachma says, this is exactly the distinction in the Mishkan. The korbanos, which are the actual mitzvahs you have to do today, they override Shabbos. But the building of the Mishkan is not a korban. The building of the Mishkan is a preliminary step that you need to take in order to bring korbanos. So just as we find by Bris Milah, it is only the mitzvah that overrides Shabbos. It is not the preliminary preparation for the mitzvah. So too by the Aveda, it is only the korbanos that are Docha Shabbos, but not the preliminary. Okay, so now, here is what the Meshech Chachma says. The Meshech Chachma says quite beautifully, and it's kind of drawing on the Sephorno. Had there not been a Chet HaEgel, we would not have viewed the Mishkan as a preliminary to bringing korbanos. In fact, would have said like the Sephardim, that you could bring korbanos anywhere you want because you have total access to God. Now, the Sephardim used it to say there wouldn't have been a Mishkan. The Mishnah Chachamim is saying there would have been a Mishkan, but the role the Mishkan would have served is not a preliminary structure to bring korbanos, but rather lehepech. The Mishkan would have been a form of korban in and of itself. I would have been serving Hashem with the homage of constructing the Mishkan. It wouldn't, in other words, it wouldn't be a machshir. It wouldn't have been an enabler because you wouldn't have needed an enabling. But it would have been a korban mitzad atzma. Ah, one second. Once it's a korban mitzad atzma, the building of the Mishkan will override Shabbos, just as a korban tamid overrides Shabbos, and a korban musaf overrides Shabbos. The Mishkan would have been a form of korban to Hashem. But, after the Chedo Egel, we are no longer deserving of bringing korbanos everywhere we want, and therefore the Mishkan acquires a secondary identity. And the secondary identity of the Mishkan is, it is the necessary structure that enables you, let me just switch the tape here. Pardon me. It is the necessary structure that enables you to bring a korban. At that point, it gets downgraded from korban to machshir korban. Once it's machshir korban, it's not going to override Shabbos, just as driving to the bris does not override Shabbos. That is why, in the pre-Mishkan structure, first there is Mishkan, and then there is Shabbos, because Shabbos is tafel to Mishkan. It is only after the Chedo Egel that Shabbos overrides Mishkan. Right? So this is again, it's a very, very ingenious. And again, the Meshech Chachma does it in a few places. He tries to be Merames, that had there not been a Chedo Egel, there are mitzvos that would have taken a different form than the form that they actually take. Now, just one other short thing about Shabbos, because it is kedai to think about, because in a sense, as Rabbi Heschel said, Shabbos is the Mishkan of time, and the Mishkan of time is greater than the Mishkan of space. So those of you that are Hasidim know that the Baal Shem Tov created a minhag that seen people who daven not Eidot HaMizrach, but people who daven Nusach Sfarad of, you know, the Ashkenazic Nusach Sfarad. That's interesting why it's even called Nusach Sfarad. But the Hasidish Nusach. So the Mincha of Erev Shabbos, before they say Ashrei, they say the Kapitel Tehillim, Kuf Zayin 107, and that is the Kapitel that actually is the source, a very important Kapitel, halachically, that is the source of Birchas HaGaymel, right? We say that there are four dangerous situations where a person has to make the Gaymel blessing. One is you were sick, you were on a sea voyage, you were in the desert, you were in a prison. Now, we generalize it to include other situations. By the way, the definition of when you're in a dangerous situation, you see, it's really sociologically determined. You know, in America, you know, a kid falls off his bicycle, you know, the Rav will tell him, bench Gaimel. In Eretz Yisrael, so, give you examples of actual shilas. You're sitting in a bus, and the seat in back of you is empty, and a rock or something goes through the glass, and it lands on the seat behind you. You ask a Rav in Eretz Yisrael, do you bench Gaimel? He says, well, if it wasn't in your row, you know, really wasn't dangerous, you know, so it's like, so people, they almost never bench Gaimel here because like everything, you know, in stride. So to some degree, you know, how afraid are you? But be it as it may, this is the source of Gaimel, because after each of these predicaments, it ends with the refrain, Yodu Lashem Chastov Nifla'osov Lufnei Adam, that they will thank Hashem for his chesed and the wonders that he performs for people. Right, so this is the source of Birchas HaGaimel. It talks about the Holchei Midbar, those who wander in the desert, Yordei Hayom, those who are in ocean voyages, Cholev and Nisrape, a sick person, again, serious illness, who gets better, and chavush bebeis ha'asurim, and the person that is imprisoned in jail. In all of these cases, yaidu l'ashem chasto v'nifla eisav livnei adam. But that's why there's a whole shaila about airline voyages. You know, technically, some are mechalic between an airplane that goes above water and not, but the truth of the matter is, a plane that goes above water, that's the safest part of the trip. It's actually safer to have a water landing than, a crash landing, God forbid, then. All right, but be it as it may, our minhag is we make gaimel for really all air voyages. But anyway, but the question becomes, maybe we'll have another share in Birchas HaGaimel, but the question is, all right, beautiful, Birchas HaGaimel, very important. You do it with a minyan. A woman after childbirth also has to bench gaimel with a minyan. But what does it have to do with Shabbos Mincha? Why do we put it in Shabbos Mincha? What's going on? So one of the explanations is that these four categories represent four types of spiritual ailments. And Shabbos is said to be a hospital for the soul, where the sick, troubled soul that is in turbulence and confusion comes to Shabbos Kodesh and gets a refuas hanefesh. Now somebody once asked Rav Kook, if Eretz Yisrael is so holy, why is there so much machlokas in Eretz Yisrael? So Rav Kook's answer is, how come so many people are sick in a hospital? I thought that's where you go, to get better. The answer is, the sick go to where they might get better. So Eretz Yisrael will attract its share of machlokas, because ultimately this is the place where there can be, I'm not saying there will be, but there can be, everything is always potential, refuas hanefesh. So in that way, Shabbos too is the hospital for the soul. So b'kitzur, just to enumerate how these four categories are, yordei hayom, the one that is drowning in the sea. So we find that the sea is often a remez to taivas, the pleasures of the world. So this is the hedonist that is totally submerged in wealth and in physical pleasures of the world, and thinks that life is only about self-gratification and pleasure. So that's like one type of sickness. That's the Yordei Hayom, the Mayim of Taiva, although Taiva is compared to water as well, but in the negative sense, it's that. And then we have Cholev Nisrapa. Cholev Nisrapa is the person who is sick. The Rambam points out that bad midos are a sickness of the soul. The person that is filled with anger, resentment, hate, jealousy, Chayli HaNefesh. Chaylev in Israel. Then we have Chavush Bebeitzo Asurim, which is a different type of sickness. That's the sickness of being dead inside. That's very different. It's not the roiling boil of the one that's angry. It's the person that lost the capacity to feel. They're like an oven, a stone. They're not able to love, they're not able to care, they're not able, a person has a deep depression. I won't even say despair, because despair already is a type of feeling. This is kind of what I mean by depression. I mean someone who doesn't feel. That's the person that is imprisoned within himself. And finally, the Holchei Midbar is actually more of a positive one, and that's the person who is looking for meaning. He's a spiritual seeker, looking for good, but he can't find it. He's like wandering the desert, looking for some way to connect to something meaningful. And Shabbos can give him what he needs as well. So the Baal Shem Tov, in his Ruach HaKodesh, saw Shabbos Kodesh as something that can give a refuah for the sicknesses of the soul, for the person that is dead inside, for the person that is filled with rage and hatred, for the person that is meshuka in the taivas of Olam Hazeh, which are often, and really it's connected, often a person gets there because if his life is bereft of meaning, they want to kill the pain in different ways. A person kills the pain. Drinking, workaholism is also a way of killing pain and the like. And the person that is searching for meaning in life but comes up dry. And this is why the Baal Shem Tov was Mesaken, that we say this chapter of Tehillim before Shabbos. So I would think, I mean, I don't do it myself yet, but I'm thinking now that I talk, I think maybe it'd be a nice minute, that it might be something. You don't have to be, you know, there used to be an old advertisement for rye bread in New York. You don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Levy's rye bread. So I would say, you don't have to be a chassid to say a chapter of Tehillim. No, we're allowed to say, Misnagdim can say Tehillim too. And there might be something to think about before we begin Shabbos, to think about that particular capital of Tehillim.